And I'll tell you why I didn't bring enough handouts. Because I'm very superstitious. I still have like 100% belief in the Ayin Hara. And I was sure that if I brought 50 handouts, there would be 3 people here. So I didn't bring enough handouts, so there wouldn't be enough handouts. If you follow the logic, do you follow the logic?
Yes.
Yes.
I'm among my own people. So I'll just say, maybe I'll just say a couple words about myself, which is that I grew up in Borough Park about, I don't know, 8 blocks away from here. I went to Beis Yaakov. I, at some point, walked into Robert Alter's office at UC Berkeley and said, I don't really have any like Jewish studies degrees, but I told him my whole story, and he said, come get a degree with me, come get a PhD. So this is just for all of you out there who have similar stories. And I can assure you, I was not an A student in Beis Yaakov. Even as not an A student, you're still ahead of a lot of people. As a B student, a C student, if you paid any attention at all, you picked up a lot. So somehow I managed to, after feeling very resentful about all the torment I was put through, I managed to make a living doing it, and now I feel as if I got my own back for the years in Beis Yaakov. Maybe that's too broad a way to put it. Anyway, I'll just say that I discovered the literature of the Haskalah, the Haskalah, in graduate school. And I remember sitting at seminars with a bunch of Israelis, and they're saying, what is it? We can't read this. Like, what is this Hebrew? What is this? You know, this is, it's not modern Hebrew. It's not. I'm like, yeah, I know this. This is how you write when all you, with your only education was you went to yeshiva, and now you're trying to write a novel. So this is Haskalah literature, and nobody's interested in it. It's a very, dusty little field. And I got attracted to it because it's so weird, and because all the people who wrote it had the same biography as I think people do in Shulant. And by the way, I'm so excited to be here in Shulant. And what I want to, and then of course, I was interested, what I'm particularly interested in is the sex, right? Well, I don't have to explain that. I'm a human being.
Don't assume anything.
So this is my talk. I want to explain how all the pieces work together. So the talk is about secularization. It's about this kind of energy, this kind of cultural energy that comes from leaving the traditional world, and what happens to those people when they become writers. And then it's about sexuality, because that's the big question. I'll explain, how do they write about sexuality? How do they become new sexual beings? And how does literature fit into all this? And I'll just give you my argument so you're not in suspense, and then I'll try to prove it. What I want to say is that the secularization, Jewish secularization, started with adopting European models, adopting ways of being, sexual ways of being, literary ways of being, social ways of being, from things that people saw, these ex-yeshiva boys, things that they saw in middle-class Europe, things that they admired. But it ended, and this is my argument, there's a big arc, it ended with world literature becoming Jewish. So that this story of people who leave Orthodoxy starts by them feeling, what do they have? They have to adopt European models. And they end up having, them and their immediate descendants end up having the hugest influence on culture, on popular culture, on literary culture. That secularization, maybe this is obvious, but secularization, it isn't just about halacha, right? It's not just about cutting off the payas or taking off the yarmulke or eating a cheeseburger. It's also, let's say, it's not just about, can I throw in some Hebrew? It's not just about ben adam lamakom. Let's say it's about ben adam lechavero. In other words, everything changes, including, let's say, social ways of being, including sexual ways of being, including gendered ways of being, including friendship. By the way, this last bit just occurred to me yesterday. So you're getting hot ideas off the press. And by the way, if you have questions or something isn't clear or you have a comment, please feel free. So even friendship, right? What is friendship in the traditional world versus what? How do you have a friend without learning Talmud with them, maybe is one question. How do you have a friend who's not a chavrusa? How do you have a friend who's maybe the opposite sex? How do you, right? I mean, this is, we hear that these autobiographies of Salman Maimon writes about he got married at the age of 11 or something, or 12, and he had never, you know, never talked to a girl before. This is the sort of autobiography, this is the collective autobiography of the writers that we're talking about. Now, I want to just immediately take away or negate a possible misconception. And the misconception is that there's this thing called religion or tradition or orthodoxy, and then you leave it and then there's nothing. It's a kind of subtraction. You never go to nothing. There's no nothing. So where do you go? Who are you? How do you dress? We're all in costume, right? I mean, Yitzhak's in costume and I'm in costume. They're just different costumes. I didn't just, you know, when I stopped wearing long skirts, I didn't go around the streets naked. You'll be relieved to hear. So what do I wear? Where do you go? What do you do? Yes, that's true. You'd be streaking. It's the real costume. So you put on a style. Now, one of the things about the style of, and when people left the firm world in the 19th century, they went a lot of places. Some of them went very wild indeed. So you get radicals and sinners and libertines and people taking drugs. And the same thing, the same broad spectrum we have today. But the people who wrote the literature were of a very narrow, specific set. So they tended to be, let's say, they tended to be of the more Balabatish families. They tended to go middle class. It's a little bit of a shame. You don't get the real radicals till the end of the 19th century, the free love people. So what they think that you should replace arranged marriage and mikvah and all that with, being Hasidic, what they think you should replace it with is proper middle class behavior. And I have a photograph here. You see the grandfather and the Strimal. And you see on the right hand side here is in my handout, you know, a woman and a man and a tall hat. That's what they were aiming for. For this group of ex-yeshiva boys, their hero was Moses Mendelssohn in Berlin. In Berlin, already the Jews had, you know, converted or become Reform. In Eastern Europe, they were still holding on to some kind of middle-class bourgeois model of what it meant to be a proper modern Jew, how to do gender. Now, one of the odd things about breaking away from the firm world is that despite the fact that there's a lot of halacha around being a man and being a woman, there's not so much gender. There's actually more gender, I think, in the secular world in the 19th century. There's more stuff about how a woman should act. There's more stuff about how a man should act. A man should do in the firm world. But femininity, masculinity, very foreign concepts to the firm world. These were concepts that had to be introduced to people who were leaving the Orthodox world. They had to be inculcated with them. And the other thing is, their problem with the firm world isn't the same problem that maybe some of us have with the firm world. It's not that the firm world was sexually repressive. They thought that the firm world was grotesquely sexual. They thought that arranged marriage, this is what they said, arranged marriage basically meant that anybody with male genitals and anyone with female genitals can be put together in a bed, and next thing you know, there'd be 11 kids. They found this disgusting. How can, you know, they wanted to change this with, there's one person out there for you, and the way that you find this person is very carefully choreographed. You meet them, your eyes meet across the room, you feel their soul. It's all about souls, right, for these people. the soulmate. This is what they believed that Jews had to be taught. There was something that there would be any circumstance in which a Rebbe or coarse and sexually coarse. And that Jews, it's not that they had to be taught something other than sex. They had to be taught something about love and romance. Thank you.
Yeah, you're screaming. And we were saying everything you say is like do, and you want to hear everything wrong.
Yes.
Europe in general secular Europe had a value of culture. Even non-secular Europe had a
culture. What culture?
Just culture in general. Opera.
Right, culture.
You know, culture was a big value in this, you know, European cities in a way that I think we don't really relate to that, you know, as Americans. And in those days, you know, I would imagine that the Maskilim, whoever was writing, you know, these, was interested in, you know, being more refined and cultured and building that into that, you know, that whole cultural.
Whatever. Yes, they all had aspirations. They couldn't get into the universities. Only toward the end of the 19th century, but they longed for that. They longed for that, and they were actually terrified of women. The women were what they considered is the true way to be enlightened. Is they didn't think women had it in them. Women were too interested in Parisian dress or playing the piano, or they were terrified of these women. They often had jobs working as tutors to women in the households of these rich bourgeois Jews, and they wanted to have like a true meaning of the mind. It was a real problem between men and women. Another thing, Jewish women were too loud. So one of the things is that, so there are all these men, first of all these men were already, is it on?
Oh,
I just turned it off?
Oh,
thank you. So these men, most of them were married by the time they managed to get out, because marriage, especially for the rabbinic elite. Oop, thank you.
Oh.
So the marriage age was much younger in the 19th century than it is now. And if you didn't get out when you were 12, you probably had a wife, and some of these Maskilim kept their wives, and some of them got divorced. But none of them had experience, really, with women. And if they were writing in Hebrew, is this okay? It sounds weird to me. So if they were writing in Hebrew, they didn't even have female readers. So they had this idea of love, because that's what European culture was. But in terms of actual practice, that they didn't really have. By the way, the picture that I have next to the that postcard of in Schularheim is a picture of I just took it because it was it's a picture of an opera called Abrevele der Kala, and one of the most, I think, a letter to the bride, one of the most, I think, telling literary projects of the 19th century was this notion of an epistolary, I think that's what it's called. It's an epistolary model. In other words, people have to be taught how to write letters to their, now all of a sudden they have something called a courtship,
And the idea that, you know, the man makes the first move, a woman acts shy, that's another thing. A woman acting shy, not part of traditional Jewish culture. I mean, the Maskilim wanted the women out of the marketplace and to just be more refined. They didn't like this traditional Jewish model where the wife is like twice the size of her husband. She could kill him by sitting on him. They wanted the man to be larger than the women, the woman. You can see it in their novels. It's not the Jewish way. The woman is usually, I don't know, all the Jewish marriages I know. So what you have is you have models for how to write a love letter. So, you know, my dear bride, and first of all, the idea that you write your bride a letter. So it's very telling that modernizing Jews, and they were an avant-garde, they were trying to convert the masses to the modern European middle class, that they needed instruction manuals in how to behave around members of the opposite sex, in what it was like to be a man. It's almost exactly the opposite of what's idealized in yeshiva boy, right? Yeshiva boy is unable, you know, he has to be skinny and pale and intellectual, and they had to learn what a true man was like. And they did this through literature. Literature was a primary, let's say literature served all kinds of functions and was itself an effect of this. If they wanted to be modern, then they needed to write something other than, you know, rabbinic responsa or commentaries on the Torah. And what could they write that would be attractive to, you know, to the masses? With the novel. The modern Jewish novel starts to be written in the 19th century, and it actually begins with an anti-Hasidic, let's see, Shivchei Habesh, in praise of the Baal Shem Tov, came out in 1816. 2 years later, you get a Haskalah parody of Shivchei Habesh called Megalat Mirin, which is a spoof on Hasidic life, with a lot of sex and a lot of, you know, shenanigans. But what they wanted to do was to bring the novel to the Jewish masses to show how to be a European, and especially to train them in terms of romance, the idea of romance. And I'll just say that the word for romance in Yiddish and in Hebrew is roman, so which is novel. The word for novel is the same for romance. So in other words, what's a novel? A novel basically is boy meets girl, and then 200 pages later, they lived happily ever after. So first of all, boy meet girl, and then 200 pages. Like, what do you do in 200 pages? There's a Vart and there's a Tanayim, right? There's no 200 pages. So like, where do you get the 200 pages? Where are the obstacles? How do you fight a duel? So this is a big problem. So the Maskilim, they want to be European, which means they want to write novels. They don't want to write responsa. But how do you write a novel when you have a wife that you've been married to since you were 14? You have like six kids, I'll read from the and this is from the biography of Mendel and Meicher Svarim, who's considered the kind of grandfather of modern Hebrew and of Yiddish literature. At some point, someone says to him, "Why don't you write?" This isn't really about writing a novel; it's about writing an autobiography. But he says, "How do you write an autobiography if you're a Jewish man who grew up in a traditional world?" Well, I'm going to tell you what my life is like. You know what my life is like because it's exactly like your life. We all lead exactly the same life. In a society in which there's no individualism, there's no autobiography. But then he goes on and he says something about why he can't write it, and it shows a little bit about what he thinks great literature is. So he says, "Neither I nor my ancestors ever amazed the world with our deeds. We weren't dukes or strategists or warriors. We never made love to charming young women. We never wrestled like billy goats with other men or served as seconds in duels and never learned how to waltz with young maidens at balls. In short, all the material that could entice a reader is lacking among us. Instead, we have the cheder and the rebbe and the matchmaker and brides and grooms and old people and babies, wives and children." He could say children, children, children. There's no children, you know, in a good novel. The story ends before that happens, you know. Whereas in the Jewish world, you know, 2 minutes later, there's a kid. So in other words, I couldn't write. I felt myself unable to write because I had this. I lacked the life experience to write a modern European novel because I grew up in the Orthodox world. So they had two. So basically, the Jewish men of this. And maybe I'll say something. Actually, let me say something about reading practices. That part of what was adopted. It wasn't just literary genres like the novel that were adopted from European culture, and it wasn't just sexual models like courtship and romance and femininity and masculinity. It was also the very idea of reading a novel. And that reading a novel, one of the interesting things is reading a novel was something that was considered a womanly pursuit, both in Europe and among the Jewish, in the Jewish world. And the Jewish world, even though the writers were almost all men, or maybe all men for many, many decades in the 19th century, their readers, or the readers of European novels, not their Hebrew novels, and sometimes the Yiddish novels, were the daughters, were the girls. And I'll read aloud a quote from a memoir, actually a late memoir, a 20th century memoir, but this was certainly the case in the 19th century. The daughters of the Kalish and Rebbetzin were favored with an aristocratic education, both knew Polish and German, read the works of Schiller, and were versed in the great novels. In the home of Rabbi Yeshua Le Kuttner, a place where the smell of books broke forth from the dusty cabinets into the surrounding rooms, the aristocratic daughters would sit by the windows and read thick Polish and German novels, their eyes streaming tears, sighing at the passionate loves depicted in them. Rising from the courtyard below was the sound of the Talmud and sing-song from the Beth Medrash students, merging with the joyful clamor of the children of the poor of the municipal Talmud Torah school. So what you have here is the entry of the novel into Jewish life, but basically only for girls. So why is that? I think it's sometimes been called the benefits of marginality. Jewish boys' education was really important. Religious Jewish boys' education was really important, especially like a Rebbe's sons. They'd be sitting and learning all day long. The Jewish girls, if they were rich enough and you know they didn't have to work in the kitchen, nobody paid much attention to their education. The tendency was for Jewish women, given that there's this pattern of Jewish women to work in the marketplace, to actually know Polish or Russian or German better than the men. And they were the kind of interface with the outside world. Sometimes there'd be a man and a woman, a husband and wife, who owned a grocery store. But the story always goes, some customer would come in and the husband would be sitting alone over his Gemara, and he'd say, wait a minute, my wife will be right back. She'd be the one dealing with the non-Jewish customers. It was just this, you know, the man was just there kind of, I don't know why exactly. You know, this concept of the Eishes Chayil, the woman breadwinner. So what you have is this very interesting situation where you have a sexually segregated society. And the Jewish society continued to be very sexually segregated, even among modernizing Jews. So you get modernizing Jewish women living kind of parallel lives upstairs, while downstairs the boys are still, the men and the boys are still doing what they've always done. And this is why you get this crisis. I just read today about the founding of Beis Yaakov. Somebody in the Aguda, someone in the organization of Orthodox, the organized political movement of the Orthodox world said, we're soon not going to have a single woman for these men to marry. So these women are reading about romance, they're reading about sex and love, and they're crying, right? That's what you're supposed to do when you read one of these novels. At the same time, there's no social framework in which to act this out in these particular circles. So back to the problem that the small, tiny male elite has about How do you write a Jewish novel set in the Jewish world? How do you do it? Where do you get the material? So there's two, I would say there's at least two ways. One way is, what I consider is, you could shoot high or you could shoot low. Mostly the Hebrew writers shot high and the Yiddish writers shot low. How did the Hebrew writers shoot high? Ahavat Zion, have you heard about Ahavat Zion? A melodramatic love story between a beautiful Jewish girl and a beautiful, handsome Jewish man who saves the Jewish girl's life by shooting an arrow at a tiger, a lion that's about to chase her. And I think you're already beginning to guess that the story is not set in Poland. The story is set in the land of Israel at the time of the prophets, the time of the prophet Isaiah. He has a bit part in it. So he basically, using biblical Hebrew, produced a romance from a time when Jewish men were still men. They knew how to ride horses, they could shoot lions with bows and arrows, and where Jewish women were demure, had perfect teeth, and were shepherdesses. And in that, back then was when you could imagine true romance between a Jewish man and a Jewish woman. And by the way, this novel, Ahavat Zion, became a hit for the people who could read Hebrew, which was an elite. And there are stories about Jewish men walking around the woods on Shabbos and reading from Ahavat Zion to the women, who maybe pretended to understand what they were hearing in Hebrew, since the women usually didn't have any Hebrew education. And the names of the two main characters, strangely enough, Amnon and Tamar, had a real spike in popularity among the Maskilim. Amnon and Tamar, of course this is Ashkenazic Hebrew, Amnon and Tamar. So that was one way to do it, and that was mostly done by Hebrew writers. The other way to do it was to shoot low, and shooting low was much more popular and much more successful. And any Yiddish novel, any novel from the 19th century that has survived to this day, survived because it went the second route. And you shoot low by making fun of traditional Jews. You do satire and farce. That's what the satirical novel in Megalat Tamirin, The Revealer of Secrets, about the Hasidic world did. It made fun of the Rebbe, made fun of one of the best known novels of the 19th century was by Mendela. It was called The Travels of Benjamin III. The Travels of Benjamin III. It was the great bestseller. It was published in 1878. It was the great bestseller of the 19th century. I'm trying to remember what's vodka and what's water. But maybe it doesn't matter. The Travels of Benjamin III, Masos Binyamin HaShlishi, and it was a story. It was translated into Polish and Russian as the Jewish Don Quixote. And what it was a retelling of the Don Quixote story in Eastern Europe. So now, I don't expect you all to have read Don Quixote recently, but Don Quixote is basically an adventure story in which someone imagined, well, I won't go into it so much, but basically it's a man who's going off looking for adventures and for women, right? Girls, women, what else would it be about? Now, since it's set in Eastern Europe, the idea that you could find two men over the age of 12 that would be going out and looking for women was impossible, since they were all married by that time. So instead of it being about two men going off looking for women, it's about two men running away from their wives. And one of them actually is so terrified of his wife, she's like with the frying pan, that he's dressed as, his name is Sender Aldiidna, he's dressed in women's clothing so that his wife shouldn't recognize him. So, and what you have here, and very small on the right, is this is performed as a play, And you see the two men with their arms around each other, Binyamin and Senderel. And Binyamin is the quote-unquote man of the pier, and Senderel is dressed like a woman. And just to show how absurd traditional Jewish men are and how far away they are from proper heterosexual desires, the way they talk to each other is in the language of the Song of Songs, Shir HaShirim. They're, you know, here, my beloved cometh to me over the hills. It's Senderel Diidna. And this was hilarious, the idea that traditional Jewish men are basically queer is the big joke of this novel, one of the big jokes of this novel. There are other examples, but this was the big funny example of the 20th century. Now, one of the things that I want to argue is that this literature remained and continued to, like, had some success. Not only because it was closer to realism than the biblical, high-flown biblical romances, but also because it expressed something positive about Judaism, despite the fact that all these writers thought they were doing was criticizing traditional Judaism. So, for instance, when Mendela says, I couldn't write a novel because I never fought a duel, he's partly making fun of Jewish men for not fighting duels, but he's partly making fun of non-Jews for fighting duels. Someone could get hurt. The idea that, and first of all, the idea that every, you know, non-Jew spends all his time fighting duels and dancing at balls, he knows that's not true. So there's a kind of double-edged irony here. It turns out that the Jewish perspective starts being turned back against the European perspective. I'll give you an example of how this works in Masos Binyamin HaShlishim, The Travels of Benjamin III. The Travels of Benjamin III is an unfinished novel, and I think I know why it's not finished. It's not because my book's unfinished. He finished plenty of books. This one he couldn't finish. The reason why it's unfinished is because it ends up that these two men are so pathetic that they get kidnapped into the Tsarist army. And they are so terrible at being soldiers that they eventually get kicked out of the army. Now, it just so happens that even as critical a maskil, a haskala writer as Mendela, still thinks it's a good thing to get kicked out of the Tsarist army. So all of a sudden, his making fun of these traditional Jews comes up against his feeling of, wait, I'm on their side. I don't want to be in the Tsarist army. I don't want to be. This kind of native Jewish sense, common sense, native Jewish something, comes out in these writers, even at their most critical. And his joke of a book loses steam. They get thrown out of the Tsarist army, and it's over for the novel. He doesn't know where they should go next, because all of a sudden, you're on their side. You're not laughing at them anymore. You're laughing at the Tsarist army. And you're thinking, yay, got out of the army. So what is it? So something about this literature managed to discover something within traditional Judaism against its own best wishes, is how I think I would put it. And then when you get to the 20th century, what you start getting is masses of acculturated, assimilated Jews, and then what you get is added to the sense of maybe there's something good about traditional Jewish life. You also get this feeling of nostalgia. And if in the 19th century what you have is a sexually segregated society in which girls are sitting in the bedroom while their brothers downstairs are studying Gemara, so sexually segregated society in which girls are reading novels, in the 20th century what you get is a sexually desegregated, assimilated Jewish audience, let's say, watching a play on Friday night instead of going to shul, and on stage is a rebbe. That's what they want. That's what they want to see. All of a sudden, where the diagnosis in the 19th century is the traditional world is obscene, it's a sexual wasteland, in the 20th century, all of a sudden, the traditional world starts looking very sexy. Now, what I want to say is that the seeds are already sown for this by what goes on in the 19th century. So I want to go back to what's considered the first Tuscola novel, which is a satire on In Praise of the Baal Shem Tov. So In Praise of the Baal Shem Tov, and it's almost impossible. Of course, the guy who wrote it was himself an ex-chassid. There's no way you could write a book like that if you weren't. And it's almost as difficult to read this novel as it is to read, you know, a very dense Hasidic text. But he, what it is you realize it's absurd. He's making fun of Hasidim, so he has all these, it's like Purim Torah, you know Purim Torah? So he has this long, extended commentary on the root Peshin Tes, which means both pshat, the simple layer of the text, and it also means to spread, lehit pashet, and it also means lefshot, to take your clothes off. So somehow he gets to, in each and every generation, the true Torah and faith in the Chachamim are further laid bare. All of this is pshat, hit pashet, until soon, God willing, we will be privileged to study the Torah without any clothes on at all. The essence of attachments is love, that he who loves the tzaddik with perfect love so that his soul is bound up with the others to the point that through his love of the tzaddik, his love of women is abolished in the sense of your love is more wonderful to me than women's love. So for the maskil, there's nothing more ridiculous than how basically to be a chassid is to be queer, is to be gay, is to be a homosexual man. There's no other explanation for why you'd rather spend your time with the Rebbe than with your wife. You know, in the from Elul to the end of Simchas Torah, it's like 7 weeks you're not home. And the accusation was, these are men who wanted to get away from their wives. Now, in the 20th century, all of a sudden, these writers are reading Freud. What looked ridiculous in the 19th century starts looking beautiful in the 20th century. All the things that they made fun of, arranged marriage, the coarseness of the body, all of those seem like beautiful, mystical, erotic ideas. What you get is this kind of modern Jewish literature, and now it's not just the novel anymore, in which the traditional world is the source of sexuality, as opposed to the end of it. The arranged marriage is the source of sexuality. I'll give you just a few examples. Actually, one really crazy example is from a Yiddish play called God of Vengeance. And the reason why I know some of you know it is because you were reading it here. Now, it takes place in a brothel, in a whorehouse, in an Eastern European Jewish town, city. And in this whorehouse, two of the prostitutes are in love with each other. One of the prostitutes and the daughter of the owner of the whorehouse. And the way that they, you know, a scene, do you know what a scene means? A scene is like an elaborate sexual fantasy where you sort of pretend not to be yourself. So who do they pretend not to be? Well, first of all, so in order to get turned on, they pretend to be a from young man and young woman sitting around the Shabbos table as they're engaged to each other. So two women in a whorehouse, which isn't sexy enough for them, somehow requiring the Shabbos atmosphere to get turned on. So this is a kind of extreme example of, you know, that's where the sex is. I'll give you two more examples. And these, I'm talking about very, 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 very famous, popular literary pieces. So let's say probably the most famous, best known Yiddish play film of the 20th century is called The Dybbuk. And the Dybbuk is very interesting because what's the big argument about the Dybbuk, about in the 19th century? Arranged marriage is the worst sin. You stifle people's right to choose their own mates. Now, in the Dybbuk, what you get is an arranged marriage, and let's just say that the big story of Haskalah is how two people who are supposed to be married according to arranged marriage refuse their arranged marriage and meet someone on their own, and in other words, the erotic passion that's the opposite of the shatran, the matchmaker, the mercenary considerations of the parents, yichus, forget yichus. You meet someone, you love the way they look, that's what it's about. Now, one of the odd things about this Jewish literature is that you think that these two plots are absolutely impossibly different from each other, right? You can't, one is about you get married to someone that your parents don't want you to get married to, right? The Romeo and Juliet plot. And the other one is the shatran and the matchmaker and the arranged marriage. Now what you get is a stream of stories in which both of those things are true. Even Ahavat Zion, a 19th century Hebrew Haskalah novel, the young man and the young woman are strangers to each other. Their parents want them to marry each other, but as a matter of fact, want them to marry other people. As a matter of fact, it turns out that their parents actually promised them to each other, but then they forgot, and one of them had to run away because someone wanted to kill him, and he had to become he was a prince, but he had to pretend to be a shepherd. So as a matter of fact, it turns out that both of these people want to get married to each other because they're turned on by each other, and because they're beautiful and handsome, and because he saved her by shooting the lion. And they also should get married, and it's okay. This is how the Maskilim are a little conservative. They're both of proper yichus, and their parents actually did engage them to each other before they were even born. And the same thing in the Dybbuk. The Dybbuk brings together the arranged marriage plot and the fighting your parents to marry the person you want to love. That's what Jews wanted. They wanted to have it both ways. They wanted to have the erotic, and they wanted to have the mystical. All of a sudden, the idea of arranged marriage is no longer so funny. The arranged marriage is about bashert. It's the word bashert. All of a sudden, it's discovered that bashert means not only the one that the shatran thinks your parents and the shatran thinks you should marry, the one who has the right yichus, but really the one that God wants you to marry. Somehow erotic love and arranged marriage turn out to be the same thing. The modern Jew wants it both ways. Yes. Nissen, is that your name?
Bronsky's play of 1918 and the movie, which I saw recently at EVO, performed in the late 1930s, the play is very anti-religious, but the movie is not.
Oh my God, the movie is, what you're getting is, part of it is nostalgia. Part of it is a feeling of, yeah, wanting to break away is the big story of the 19th century. Then you've broken away, and then you have modern life, and then modern life is about the nuclear couple, right? That's what you thought you wanted. You thought you wanted true love, your soulmate, etc. But then why do you feel so empty? Where's the community? Where's the relationship to the family? Where's the extended... I mean, the movie, it's interesting, the movie is... Right. The movie is actually, it's a double love story. It's the love story between the two fathers that meet in the yeshiva, that promise their children to each other, and it's a love story between the young boy and the young girl, and both of those are necessary. And I have a few more thoughts about that, but I want to hear. Nikki, is that right?
It sounds a little bit like, almost like what they accuse modern orthodoxy of today, where the people want to, you know, people, I don't know who, accuse modern orthodoxy of wanting to live in both worlds, both the modern secular world and also the religious from world. And it almost sounds to me like it's not like it was, you know, this 100-year-old man that wrote this, you know, 100 years ago and now he left, but now he's getting nostalgic, but rather those that were then leaving with this, you know, emancipation that happened and everything is open to them. And they want the best of both worlds. So they want the beauty, let's say, that they see in Frumkeit or in Yiddishkeit, as well as the, you know, what appeals to them in the secular world. That's what it sounds like to me, as opposed to, you know, just this like, well, we left it already, now we're secular, but we have nostalgia, we want it back. It sounds like it's like a...
It's not, I mean, in some ways it's not. It's different from modern orthodoxy because here are people leading a kind of hybrid life. So they have, you know, they're professionals, but then on Shabbos, they're, you know, they have that. This is totally secular Jews. We're talking about the writers, the filmmakers. We're talking about totally secular Jews making art about the religion and investing religion with an erotic quality that it's that they feel that modern life lacks. And let me throw out an idea at you, and then I saw a couple more hands up. Here's my idea. This is my idea is that these people discovered something about the traditional world. And what they discovered, and I think I got it down to one sentence. What they discovered is that in the 19th century, the idea is that the Orthodox world is a place that represses sexuality. And in order to break away from it, you move to heterosexual romance. That's the model. What they discovered is about the Orthodox world, and I think you could see it in the literature that they produced, is that the traditional world, as opposed to being sexually repressive, is sexually polymorphous. So what it is I would say it has a bisexual distribution of sexual energy. And the Maskilim already saw this. They saw this by making fun of the Hasidim. On the one hand, on one side, there's what I would call a partially eroticized homosocial sphere. So you have a totally sexually segregated world. On one side of it, is places where men, mostly men, in some cases women, hang out together in ways that are partially sexualized. I'm not going to say it was a gay bathhouse in the Hasidic court, though some people did accuse him of that, but there was a kind of sexual energy in those arenas. At the same time that you have this partially eroticized homosocial sphere, you have a partially de-eroticized heteronormative sphere, by which I mean you have everybody gets married, you don't get to be gay, no such thing as sexual orientation. Everybody's in both of these worlds. Everybody's in the world of the sexually segregated traditional world, and then they're married to someone. And that's partially de-eroticized, by which is meant no expectation that you were attracted to or fell in love with this woman.
I'm going to give you the short one, and then when someone has a question, they
oh, okay.
Can
oh, good idea. Okay. I think this one's a little less. Is it on? I just turned it off.
No. It's actually. This one sort of has to aim your voice.
Okay. Oh, that's good. Oh, that's better, I think.
Yeah, it's better, Mike. Just more. It's not
yeah.
As swam.
It's not as. I think I'm going to take it out. So,
So if anybody has a question.
Oh, yeah, so
pick it up and then turn it on or turn
bisexual
it off.
Distribution of sexual energy. I've said this a few times.
Okay,
I got
that's
it. A partially eroticized homosocial sphere combined with a partially de-eroticized heteronormative sphere.
Everybody participates in this. I'll just say one thing of more about this, which is that these two spheres are connected, not only because everyone participates in them, but because the one of the ways that the homosocial sphere is partially eroticized is that it's the source of shidduchim. It's the source of, in other words, I marry your sister, you marry my brother, whatever, our cousin marries each other, and what you get is you get an eroticized network that far exceeds the individual couple. So that, and you get something like machatanim. I sometimes ask people, like, what's the English definition of machatanim? And there is no English definition, because there's no kinship term that works beyond the diagonal. In other words, my parents, in English, my parents, my husband's parents are my in-laws, but they're not the in-laws of, you get it, there's no, in other words, there's kinship that's built through homosocial spheres, right? Because the men often are arranging, or the women are arranging, so that what you get is, this is the network that ultimately creates community, and it distributes, it can afford in some way to de-eroticize the heterosexual couple, because it doesn't place all of its erotic energy on that sphere of life. Now, one of the reasons that I think that modern life was depressing is because it was, not only was it heteronormative, so if you happen to be gay, you were totally out of luck, but even if you happen to be straight, you were out of luck, because it still narrowed it seemed like it was expanding sexual possibilities, sexual excitement, sexual freedoms, but it was actually narrowing it in certain dimensions. Okay, I really want to hear what you all have to say in questions. Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay. So I wanted to, I have a question, but I wanted to bring up two points. You know, we talk about these arranged marriage, and arranged marriage has been going on since before the beginning of time in many ways. And so in the Eskimos, they would have people come as a guest, and they'd sleep with, the husband would offer his wife up to sleep with him. Hopefully she would get pregnant, and that they would expand their sphere of influence and have family in other places. On another issue, a friend of mine had an arranged marriage, and he's Indian. And I asked him, how did that work? And he said, very interestingly, it said that you live with your wife, and then you learn to love her. And there's that very interesting, intuitive, intimate sense of that, and that's from an Indian perspective. I'm just wondering, maybe we're not really looking at the historical perspective beyond the Jewish circumstance.
Oh, no, you mean I'm not looking at, yeah, I mean, I think the we're talking about traditional marital arrangements, which are, let's say, the idea that you marry, that the person you're married to is someone you love more than anyone else, is a fairly modern idea in many cultures. So marriage is a kind of arrangement. Children, economical, I mean, all sorts of tasks that it fulfills, way beyond, let's say, the affective or the romantic or the sexual. And it's the modern world that in some ways said, this is the unit, this is the most sublime human experience you can ever have, is a romantic feeling for your spouse or for your beloved. And I think saying that this is a common experience of other post-traditional cultures is absolutely right. I think that we're living in a post-traditional society in which we're recognizing that what we wanted romantic love to do, and I think this is true for gay couples too, because it doesn't work any better for gay couples. I think it works a little better for gay couples. I think that the isolating factor of marriage and whatever is stronger for heterosexual couples than it is for gay couples. There seems to be more openness toward community. But yes, I think it's a phenomenon that goes way beyond the Jewish world.
Yes.
Can you take the microphone?
Do you know if the concept of basheret was invented to rationalize arranged marriages? Is it connected?
The genealogy of basheret. I've thought a lot about the word basheret. First of all, it has a long folk history. And I haven't, it's way, oh, there's an enormous cockroach here. I think it's a great research topic. One of the things I just want to point out about the way it's used is that it has, what are some of the uses that you know? I mean, it means the person who's...
It's used a lot, you know, that it's Bashert from forever.
Which is the moment of conception.
I mean, that's the Talmud, it's a Yiddish term. What's the Yiddish term translation of one Hebrew word?
It's the concept. But it's identical.
So the concept is, so one question that you can ask is, when does the word Bashert become a synonym for the one I truly love? And is that a modern phenomenon? No, it is. When you look at modern secular poetry, when I say you're my basheret, it draws on the old traditional meanings, but it also just means I'm crazy about you. So when does that happen? Is part of the question. I haven't done the research. I want to know. Yeah.
Just today, I posted on Facebook the fact that Lord Sacks, the chief rabbi, has denounced homosexuality from a biblical point of view.
It shows he's not a traditional Jew. No.
Okay. What's your point of view?
So the question of homophobia in the traditional world. So I've just said that there's a certain kind of homoerotic energy within the traditional world. Does that mean that it's not also homophobic? Now, the whole question of, you know, what is the laws of homophobia? I mean, there are people who would say that an Orthodox rabbi, I would call him kind of centrist Orthodox, that he comes out against homosexuality, that he knows that there's people called homosexuals. That's an invention of modernity. That's what some of the idea that there are people who are homosexual and that there are people who are heterosexual is a fairly new idea. The idea that everybody might want to do some of that every once in a while seems to be what people think in the 19th century. I mean, what they seem to think is that the anti-Hasidic literature says that Hasidim are people who want to spend time with other men a little bit more than other men want to spend time with other men. It makes them a little, but everybody wants to do it, and it's like a desire, and they Hasidim give into it a little too much. But they don't see Hasidim as homosexuals. What would it mean to call most of the Orthodox world homosexual? They see them as you know, something. So I think that, I don't think that homophobia is deeply built into traditional Jewish life. I think the more modernizing you are, there's Jewish law and what it has to say, you could call it homophobic, but it's not directed against types of people, and the suspicion is...
Just to clarify, the law is specifically about the act. Nothing more and nothing less.
Right. So it's not about people.
It's about the act. And in that sense, what the rabbi said is, to me, no news at all. Obviously, if you're an Orthodox rabbi, you're going to be against the homosexual act. It says you get stoned for it. It's not
you can be against homosexual acts. To be against homosexuality is a sign of assimilation. Because it's not, I mean... What?
Entertain the talk.
I would say that. I think... By the way, let me get... Yeah?
effective assimilation, you mean.
But it's not just 20th century America. I mean, I've heard my mother say that her father was like kept out of yeshiva because everyone knew that in yeshiva boys slept with each other. So, you know, even in Eastern Europe, there were these rumors going around. But at the same time, there was still this, you know, it wasn't like if you slept with a boy in yeshiva, it meant you weren't getting married, you were moving to the big city and going to gay bars. It just meant that you were having a little more fun in the yeshiva in a certain explicit way than you really were supposed to. So, right.
I think so. I mean, I'm still trying to figure that out.
One of the questions that everyone asks about Yiddish literature is why is it so interested in cross-dressing? And the idea that all these people were gay or that the whole culture was gay in some way is weird to me. So I think I have another explanation. Orthodox culture and then the Yiddish culture that described this traditional culture seemed to have one joke. You look at Yiddish novel after Yiddish film after Yiddish play, and you see a lot of cross-dressing. So, and at the same time that, what? Well, no, when you get to the secular 20th century, the great Yiddish star of the stage and screen was Molly Picon, who dressed like a boy. I'm not saying she wasn't amazing. At the same time, you know, she didn't. What is it about Jews that would be their star as opposed to Sarah Bernhardt or Jenny Lind? What is it about this culture that was so intrigued by cross-dressing? A little bit, yes. First of all, you have Sandra Ladigna and Marcel Spinyamin Ashlishi. The main character of The Travels of Benjamin III is a cross-dressing man. Molly Picon?
You're standing too close to the speaker.
Be part of the conversation. So it's hard to talk.
Yeah. I'll project.
One of her biggest books. Molly Picon was a storyteller. One of her greatest books ever written was Who Knows 10. And it's a children's book. And it's based on the Ten Commandments. It was released in... The originals were released in the late 1800s, but if you ever listened to the Jewish Stories Erev Shabbos on the radio, in the early 70s, she used to read them on the radio, and it was amazing. I actually have a copy, and I have her on tape reading them. Nina Schramm has re-recorded them.
So I just want to talk about Molly Picon as a cross-dresser for a minute.
But she started
right.
And her stories talk a lot of it, have that in them as well. And they are just amazing to, and they go back to that as well. But her storytelling, as a storyteller, she did that.
Right.
She started out as a storyteller. And the storyteller culture has a lot of it.
So Molly Picon, there's a film called Yidel Mitten Fiedel, where some of you have seen it, where Molly Picon dresses as a boy and joins a klezmer band. And you all know Yentl. So Yentl, a girl who dresses like a boy and goes to yeshiva. So what is this all about? So here's the way to learn, but also about, in the case of a way to be, so in one way it's a way to get past the exclusion of women from traditional spheres in which they weren't permitted, like playing in a klezmer band or learning in yeshiva. That's part of the story. But both of these stories also have a love story in which, let's say, a real man or a man dressed like a man has a kind of friendship with a woman dressed like a man, and she feels something, and he feels something too, but he doesn't know what. And obviously this is played for laughs, Well, what I think is going on here is, why is this such an important story for this particular post-traditional generation, is that what they wanted was, on the one hand, heterosexual romance, on the other hand, heterosexual romance minus the gender roles that go with it. So no femininity, no masculinity, the kind of camaraderie that can only happen between a chavrusa, two chavrusas. So it's a kind of fantasy about the possibility of true love that combines the chavrusa relationship, or the relationship between klezmer musicians with heterosexual romance, or not even romance, because the word romance no longer applies. The word romance is so ruined by femininity, masculinity, all that. So the idea is that if we could have the chavrusa, if we could have the klezmer musician, if we could have that, and we could have sex with our chavrusa, then that would be the ideal, right? We were just talking about this. The chavrusa sexual relationship is what Yentl's about, I think. And what's been lost in modernity, what we no longer have, because we have Hollywood romance. Yes.
I don't know if I'm allowed to.
You're not allowed.
Disagree with the theory.
No, please.
Because it's a theory. But I love the question. And I feel like it almost betrays the innocence of, from Jews, that the greatest thing, their greatest fantasy, is to just have something that they don't have. And it's like, oh, if I could only learn like a boy. Or if a guy might say, I don't know what a guy would say, maybe for guys it's different. But yeah, if I could only get into, yeah, like I have a feminine side or something. And so whatever it's like for the men, but for a girl, I can imagine not having like a desire for a relationship per se, but a desire to learn like men learn. And so I think it's actually quite endearing that instead of having these like, you know, bizarre sexual fantasies, it's so innocent. It's like the frum Jew who's been denied a certain, you know, range of experience, like when they have this great desire, it's like, I just wanna put on a hat. Yeah, it's like, I just wanna, you know, wear pants. Oh my gosh, you know. So, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't know the psychology of, like, you know, a whole.
I guess I'm reading it from the psychology of secular Jews. In other words, you're looking at, I could see the psychology of, look, I could see the psychology of wanting to cross that border. If you're a religious Jew living in a seriously sexually segregated society, the desire to cross that border is built into it, right? The border is there to create desire. Why else is it there? That's what everyone says. The, you know, family purity laws, quote unquote, are there to make you have a lot of babies. So all these things that appear to be sexually repressive are in fact engines of sexual energy. But what I think is that the desire that we're talking about now is the desire of the secular Jewish playwright or actress or audience looking at this and thinking, yes, I walked into this theater on a Friday night with my husband wearing the latest fashion and having my, you know, my hair made up.
Okay? If we will have Sharia law,
none of this will take place.
I feel like I basically have experienced Sharia law,
so I'm fine with, but thank you. Yes, Ted. Oh,
is it
sorry.
Also,
that's what it's built around, for, yeah. to borrow a phrase, forbidden fruit is the spark of all this sexuality.
The sexuality is constructed by lack and separation.
Bullet.
Right. On the other hand, I mean, that's one, yeah, I think that that's partially
true. That's the same thing about cross-dressing. I think it's forbidden, so it becomes sexualized as a result of that.
Right.
Well, so, but also many years, it was a male who acted like a female actor, and because the females weren't able to act, so there was that cross-dressing in many different cultures, not just right. the.
I think, yeah.
I grew up in Borough Park, and my father had gone to yeshiva in Europe, way back in Europe, when his friends went to gymnasia. He was a big Talmud Chacham. At the same time, he had read all these books way back in Europe, and he used to tell me, like, you know, you're reading nonsense, like, you don't discuss the real writers. And I'm getting to my question, but my main sense from him was like a real sense of nostalgia and how these writers were painting the lives of what was, and even when they were like pointing out the flaws that came from love and just feeling for the Jewish life. Then I went to Beis Yaakov where they would say like, look at these akharsim, and they were mocking, and so two things. Number one, I'm curious what your sense is, where were they really coming from? Like, what I know you said like at some point it switched, but like, what was their real sense of what the Jewish traditional life was like? And also, I'm just curious about, because you're talking about like one specific part, like the erotic and romantic part, but wasn't it a bigger thing? Are you just picking out one aspect of it, or are you saying that this was like the main focus of the writing?
No. I think.
I think that the Maskilim really were very critical and really thought that traditional life was terrible. And they, I think that despite themselves, they sometimes managed to discover something in it. That's what that's my feeling. That because they were writing literature and because they presented this and they presented it honestly, they found all kinds of things. In terms of whether what they saw was tradition was just about sex, they were looking at religious life in its entirety and finding all kinds of things they loved about it. Partly it's because they were modern, and modern people, it was part of international modernism to be interested in traditional, I mean, everybody was getting back to tradition. Everybody was discovering the folk genius and the archaic, and people were, you know, were collecting African masks. So things that had seemed so embarrassing to like a generation earlier seemed cool and rich and authentic. And the Dybbuk is, it's not just about sex, it's about everything. You can do, you learn how to do an exorcism, you can actually, the whole Jewish wedding almost in real time, it's the most unbelievable. You know, you're going through a Jewish wedding without even getting a piece of chicken. That's how you feel. You're like, at least feed me, you know? So there, it's ethnography. It's like, it's a kind of, let me just finish, because I feel like there's a lot of crazy energy, and there's another party going on there. So let me just get to my end. So what I think happened is that Jews function, basically, if you want to say that there's a kind of, a kind of opposition between European ways of thinking about sex. So sex is about the sublime, it's about having one person who's your true soulmate, it's about spirit as opposed to about the body. That the people who changed that, I think it's no coincidence that the people who brought sex back to earth for Europe were Jews. Freud among first among others. So what did Freud say? Freud says, yes, you know, it's true. We basically, you know, our great grandparents thought you put a boy and a girl together in a bed, it doesn't matter who they are, and the cat, in the dark, all cats are alike. He said, that's basically what human beings are like. There was a certain kind of coarseness, a certain kind of realism about sex that comes from Freud, that's expressed in the American scene by Jewish writers saying something about, you know, the romantic sublime, we know about that, and we were never entirely persuaded. And it turns out that what we've discovered is that Jewish tradition has both of those ways of looking at sex. The Bible, if you look at the Bible, the greatest romantic love story, right? A man works 7 years to marry this woman who's the true love, but it, as a matter of fact, he accidentally sleeps with his sister and fails to notice. So you get, in one story, those double truths. And then what you get in Philip Roth, in Lenny Bruce, in Erica Jong, is to say, those great romantic love stories that we believed we had to emulate, well, let's tell you the other side of those stories. And I think that world literature has paid attention. Thank you. What can I do? He was?
Would you like people to gather around the band?
Should we keep talking? The other thing is, Yitzhak told me that I should tell people that you could go to Beis Yaakov and even not be an A student, as I wasn't, and then get a PhD in Jewish studies and, you know, make a parnassa from it.
So all you guys have to go to Beis Yaakov.
That's amazing.
Yeah, but you can read everything in the original Yiddish.
Yeah. I would love to. I have your card, right?
Yeah. The dip inside.
Yeah, do you want to make an announcement about gathering?
Thank you.
Erica John.
For anyone interested in continuing the conversation and the dialogue, just move up a little bit so that the circle can become tighter, and then people can go do whatever they want in the back, but people interested.
This is pre-modern.
What does he say about it?
Here.
It's much around Torah.
Here.
So in other words, this was a release.
Ramah's really interesting character. Because he really believed in sort of...
he wasn't
the
liberal by constitution.
He believed in the sanctity of minhag, and he was very against codification. So in some ways he's saying, you know what Jews do? That's Jewish law. They cross-dress on Purim. We think that the rabbis, like, people go ask a shayla, and then the rabbis go look in all the books. But that's not how it worked. In the Middle Ages, you'd like, what, you had a chicken, you can spend, 3 months sending a letter somewhere. You do what you did, and then the rabbis decide whether they're going to go against minhag or not. That was their soul. And he didn't. He didn't.
Who's he?
The Ramah.
Oh, yeah, well, to an extent. To an extent, yeah.
I really want to hear from you all about my ideas.
What you said about mechotanim. I think that mechotanim is a...
Mahatanim.
Yeah, that's a biblical concept. Mahatanim is because the only chasan mentioned in the Torah is chasan means son-in-law, and kala means daughter-in-law. It's not the way we use the word today.
But mahatanim is a different concept.
The relationship is
a Yiddish word.
But the whole structure that you...
And what's the time to be?
Kichatan tamim atali.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
So we talk about sex? I want to hear from you, what?
We'll be in touch.
Really nice to talk to you. Yeah.
wrong with cross-dressing on birth? I don't know, there's nothing wrong with cross-dressing on Pesach, in my opinion. You're asking me, should I stroke my beard? No, it's interesting. There's supposedly Jewish law, you're not supposed to cross-dress. And then there's Jewish custom, which is cross-dressing. But it wins. Yeah.
So we got a youngin here.
I just want to know what this is.
You want to know what?
What is this right here?
What is what?
What is this?
We just had a lecture.
Right.
And
you asked me what's on the lecture?
Yeah.
So I didn't hear the lecture. So
You can hear the questions.
Oh, yeah.
Avram Moshe.
He's a Rosh Hashiva, and I went to school with his one son, two sons, three sons probably, at some point.
I've seen him once in about 20 years.
I heard you speak about learned Yiddish versus Yiddish that you pick up at home at the conference in San Francisco. Just wondering if you could comment on today's learned Yiddish.
So I just read yesterday in the Evo archives that Sarah Schneer's Yiddish was no good.
Pardon?
We think, you know, we have this idea that someone like Sarah Schneer, the founder of Beis Yaakov, was, a native Yiddish speaker. She wasn't. Already in Poland, the Hasidim in Krakow were speaking Polish, especially the women.
If you read the Holocaust, the memoirs of many of the people from the Holocaust, you see that their native tongue was Polish, and Yiddish was spoken mainly by the men in Cheder and Beis Medrash, but the women speak Yiddish. There was a few books that
I'm
read like that.
What do you, how do you feel about so-called the modern Yiddish that is spoken by people who learned it from in college?
You know, I have, like, when you grow up from, and you grow up, you know, I grew up in a Yiddish-speaking family, you have a real snobbery. Like, you can become not from, but you still remain a snob. At least I did. And I had to get my snobbery out of me. And I'm a snob about a lot of things, like going to a conservative synagogue, you keep your whatever, without maintaining anything else, like without maintaining a belief in God, without maintaining keeping Jewish law, you can still be a frum asshole. So,
can we quote you on that?
Right? Are we like frum assholes? So yeah, like to be a snob about someone's Yiddish because they learned it in a classroom, as opposed to, so they learned it in a classroom. I've worked hard. There are a lot of ways in which I see that I'm still, I associate a lot of parts of my personality with a certain kind of, I mean, you know, there's also good things, I hope, but there's a lot of looking down at, let's say, everybody. You know, on the one hand, I don't want to be from, I don't want my kids to be, I don't want to live in that environment. On the other hand, I'm better than every conservative Jew or reformed Jew because I went to Beis Yaakov. It's ridiculous.
Do you think it's fixable in any way? Do you think that's
not right?
Do you think there's hope about the situation?
What?
Do you think this helps? For example, what you're talking about, looking down at everybody else who's not like you, or the from asshole, or you know, all that stuff. Like those of us in the community that look at it and are ouch. Like those of us that look at our own communities and are like, ouch, like is this my religion? Is this, you know, like is there anything you think that can be done in some small way to affect change?
Sure, how about this place? I don't even understand what it is, but I'm kind of, you know, just that there's a conversation like this going on, my experience, I'm coming from my mother's house. I was wearing a skirt when I got here. My experience, I could just say what I just said. I mean, just everything I experienced was that you can't say anything. There's only like six things you can say. And right now I'm doing research on Sarah Schneer.
On what?
I'm sorry, Schneer, this Yaakov Jamel, the founding of Orthodox Girls Education. And here's a woman who made a revolution in the Orthodox world, but wasn't allowed to say so. And I have to say, I had 2 days of reading in the archives, and I feel like one more article about, oh, what a big tzaddik, what a big, you know, over and over and over again, the same 6 things you're allowed to say. And I just to feel like you're allowed to say things.
There's so many of us who, like, there's so many of us who grew up not with that. Like, I feel like Orthodox Judaism changed in my lifetime. Like, it really changed in my lifetime. I didn't grow up with it. So, like, it's like, you changed that religion on me. And I don't know.
I actually say things to my family. Like, I come back and I see things that are just shocking to me because it wasn't like that 25 years ago.
Right.
So, first, no women in the newspapers, no photos of women. And none of that, oh, it's always been like that. It's always been like that.
Mother always worried about that thing.
But no.
Just a comment on your comment on Yiddish is that a lot of the secular Yiddishists that learn the language have their own snobism. They think they speak much better than people here in Borough Park. That's another snobism. So, but I think that here it's much more natural, it's flowing. It's a flowing Yiddish, while theirs is sort of a little bit stuttering.
Mine isn't fluent anymore either. And
what you said at the end about that they found that romanticism, that what they were looking for wasn't out there. Could you elaborate a little bit more?
What who was looking for?
What, either the maskilim or the people, the Yiddish, whoever was writing this, that the romantic sexual idealism that they were looking for, that they didn't find that out there, so they had to go back to tradition.
What would I say? I think that Eastern European Jews were no matter how completely secular they became, they didn't do European heterosexual romance well. The women were too loud and too fat, and the men were too nebushy, and they didn't excel at it. They weren't sexy. They never made it as that ideal. And they were traumatized by that. And the traditional world, as they remembered it, freed them from that, you know, femininity, masculinity.
You have to have these roles that society was, that secular society was prescribing to them. Interesting. Okay.
That's my theory.
Maybe Sisyphus, who was bound to the rock in the same way as Hasidim, maybe there was a freedom in being a prisoner, being bound to something. By knowing where you are, or who you are, by defining who you're not.
Yeah, I mean, why, you know, people like to be tied up during sex. So maybe there's something exciting about living a whole life when you're tied up.
How much of the market was there? I mean, obviously these books sold. Who was buying them? I mean, who was buying them? Who was reading them? There had to have been enough to print to make money to.
Aside from that, it's women reading. They always say that the best-selling novels, there's all these novels that take place in the Hasidic court where the Rebbe is a charlatan and he rapes young girls and outrageous novels. And they always say, you know who is reading those novels? Hasidim. Who else you want to read about yourself? And some of these novels were very funny. There's one novel that takes place, the best-selling novel of the 19th century of all time, was a novel called The Hasidish Yingel. And it's about a young boy is being raised in the Hasidic court, and it starts with him in the womb, and he's trying to figure out if he's a boy or a girl, but so he's listening to what people are saying, but he can't focus because the angel is teaching him Torah. You know how the angel is teaching him Torah? So the only time he hears what's going on is when the angel falls asleep. So it's like, this is a novel that's making fun of Hasidim, but it's very funny and enjoyable. It's like, it's still funny. I totally recommend it. It's been translated into English as The Polish Boy. And who would enjoy it but either a chassid or an ex-chassid? Who else would get all the jokes?
Where did they sell these things? I mean, they're obvious.
Weren't there a lot of masculine people that came on from? I mean, over time.
Yeah, but it's not like it was... They're not...
It works. Yes, it does.
It's all like... It's all like, you know, Shalom Aleichem. It's all making fun of, he's making fun of, he's using this Yiddish thing of the internal translation. Shaiftim, b'shaiftim, yachtim, please, titim, l'cha. But he turns it into these mistranslations. So it's impossible to translate. I mean, when people, you know, it's like Shalom Aleichem, you really need to have gone to yeshiva for like 10 years to understand Shalom. I mean, to get what's funny about it. So you have like these generations of for like 200 years, there was always a bunch of ex-Orthodox people. It just stopped being that way fairly recently, like the last generation, and now here there's another one. So these are the readers, the ex-Orthodox Jews. Everybody was an ex-Orthodox Jew. That's who they, you know, that was modern Jewish culture.
A lot of them
the children they weren't even understanding.
Right. And it was they were reforming conservatives. Right. So it was all the reforming conservative Jews.
That was much later.
But what about the sexual propensity of a lot of the Orthodox Jews to go and experience it outside of the religion?
So this whole question of, I mean, the other thing I didn't talk about is that one of the reasons why the Maskilim stopped, like turned back to tradition, is because they got scared of intermarriage. That was the, so when you read Shalom Aleichem, the five daughters or whoever, is the daughter who's the poor daughter, the one who marries Muttel, and then there's the second daughter that marries a communist, and Tevye's like, right on, you know, I'll get your mother to agree. And then there's the third daughter that wants to marry a non-Jew. And suddenly, Shalom Aleichem's freaking out. And the whole, you know, your sympathies go with the father. And once your sympathies go with the father, then you're talking traditional Judaism. Because Tevye is a traditional Jew. And all of a sudden you're thinking, maybe we went too far.
And on the other hand, I think at the end of the story, he says, why do we have to have this division between Jew and non-Jew? Doesn't he say that at the end?
You know, it was a kind of question. The Maskilim were universalists, but they were also conservative in some way. They wanted to maintain the Jewish people. And they didn't know what to do about intermarriage. And the whole game was, all of Jewish literature up until that point was on the side of the young. It's the young people who we care about. Their rebellion, their love, their whatever. Let their parents suffer. To hell with their parents. And then all of a sudden, when you're crying in chapter 3 of Shalom Aleichem, you're crying for Tevye. It's the first moment in Yiddish literature where a Jewish parent, a traditional Jewish parent, gets the sympathy of all the readers. So something's going on there. I really feel like that's a major...
America, and he says, "We'll be in Chicago." You know, like at the end, he does draw
her in.
That's
the movie. Is that the original
book?
Is that the book?
You know,
it's not working.
It's, you got to turn it
off. He doesn't go to America in the Yiddish book. No.
Yeah, okay.
Bela goes to America. One of the daughters.
Do you see a way? I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I'm Fiddler on the Roof. I grew up non-Orthodox, and I was involved in theater, and I played Chava, the girl who marries out. And, right, so...
Could you give us a rendition?
No, but what I just hearing the perspective of this play and the characters from the point of view of the Orthodox viewer, at the time, I was a non-Orthodox Jew,
And I felt like there's no way that this was about traditional Judaism. You were like, you, for sure, the audience, the secular audience, relates to the Chava character because it's like, hello, she loves him. It's like, duh, she loves him. Of course, let her marry him. And you're like mad at the Orthodox Jew. Why is he so traditional? So I just wanted to like throw that in, that it's not, it, like for most of,
yeah, response.
Secular, I don't know, like maybe I was just in a secular, you know, milieu. Like my whole community was Reform and conservative, and
he really, what's it called? He weighs the dice. He doesn't want you to think it's okay because he turns the guy into a pogromchik. The guy's,
you know, he was a literary scholar, like he, the
pie guy kind of shit, you know.
If you read Shalom Aleichem's Tzavua, you'll see that he rejects anyone who turns into a Christian. He doesn't want anything to do with them.
Right.
That's in the will.
Which is his own son, right?
Right.
No, the question of what happens when you leave.
Excommunicate anybody who went out of it. Out of the religion.
Anyone who converts to Christianity.
Was
that was like, so here are these secularists. Supposedly they don't believe in God, a lot of them. They believe in the universal brotherhood of mankind because they're enlightenment people. And then there's just like this stubborn conversion to Christianity thing. And that's what happens to Chava, you know, in Shalom Aleichem.
See that play? How do you see what was reflecting in now what is, or could it or would it or?
Well, great question. I want to hear what you all think. I think that there's a sort of cultural energy coming out of the break with Orthodoxy again. And you could talk about a lot of different people's, I think it has a different feeling because when it's happening, I think it is about, I don't think it's about bourgeois femininity anymore. I think it's just like it's about sexual freedom versus sexual, like once again. I don't know, I used to think that only girls, when they leave the Orthodox world, are suspected of doing it for the sex, because they become bums. As soon as you're not a frum woman, you're a bum, right? The idea is, who are you having sex with? It's not, what are you thinking? What philosophies do you have? Uh-oh, chas v'shalom, are you reading Spinoza? No one cares if you're reading Spinoza. They just care what you're wearing, right? Whereas men, there's at least the option of being an apikoros. So it's like men become apikorosim, women become bums. Those are our choices. And one of the things that made me so angry was that I wanted to be an apikoros. I didn't want to be a bum. And it was not a gendered option for me. No one cared what I believed.
So what about AIDS? And how that influenced the religious right?
AIDS?
Yeah, because what happened was the AIDS brought people back to monogamy. And with AIDS became a much bigger religious movement in this country.
Yeah, I was just talking to someone who left Orthodoxy and then went back when AIDS hit. That probably played a role. The idea that you're safer in the religious world. Also, the other question is, where do you go? Like, if you're a maskil, maybe there's somewhere to go that I don't know about. But when you're a maskil, or in the 19th century, you go to become a Zionist or a socialist or a radical or an enlightenment. Where do we go? We go to Manhattan? We go to California? What is there? What is the movement? There's no secularist ideology. The American secular world just feels like, oh, then the other thing is, did you do it because you want to become rich?
There's no, like, what?
Or because you can't be counterculture, because it's the Hasidim who are countercultural.
Yeah. I don't. Yeah.
No. you seem to rely very much on Yiddish literature. You know, you go back to examples of Yiddish literature. So I'm just curious if you can comment on the value of literature, but also the value of the language itself in perpetuating Judaism or Jewish identity.
So I think that one of the reasons why I say thank you, one of the things I think literature is so interesting is because if you look at the world that is, then you only see half the story. In other words, if you look at these guys, you see a bunch of secular writers hanging out in a cafe. If you look at what they're writing and you see their attitude towards, you know, the Rebbe or Hasidim, then what you see is that people don't just live the world that you see. They live multiple worlds. And literature...
Open windows.
Yeah, and the past, the present, what could be, what isn't, what almost was, all of that became possible through literature. And that was a gift that European culture gave the Jews. And what they did with it is they lived double lives. They lived lives as secularizers and as traditionalists, I think.
How about the language?
I feel like maybe that's, I don't know.
It's out of question, out of order or what?
I don't want to lecture so much. What becomes available in the Jewish language?
The Jewish language is a reflection of...
Secular Jew, writing in Hebrew and Yiddish in the 19th and 20th century, you have something in common with the traditional world that you left behind that you don't if you're Nathan Englander.
Right.
You have a rich, intimate language, a Jewish tradition, even if you left it behind. So like even a secular Jew calls toilet paper Asher Yotzo Papir. That's just what it's called.
You'll have a lot of stuff like that.
The word for toilet paper in Eastern Europe, among you know the most secular groups, were Asher Yotzer Papir. They didn't know what Asher Yotzer was, but they knew what toilet paper was.
So can you talk a little bit about Erika Jong and Henry Miller, because they were very influential in the secular movement.
I think my voice is going.
Pioneers of women's Hatzalah, or women's...
Really?
As well,
I read something about it. I want to hear.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed your speaking. I'm Miriam. I'm from LA. I live here now. And I was heading out, but I was just going to say thank you. And I was telling my friend, Lainey, Miriam, just to let you know that, like, yay, the women in Borough Park are doing Hatzalah. And it's really interesting because they're fighting all kinds of...
But it's much better because then the women can help the women and men will help the men and it won't
be. Yeah, I'm a labor coach, so I'm in the birth field and that's what it's for, female sensitive calls. But there's just, unfortunately, there's like a lot of negativity around it and people won't talk about it. And there's lots of women themselves who like I trained with and they don't want to even join. But fortunately, there's also a large group of women who just keep working at it. So it's interesting. Because you mentioned Sarah Schneer and I when I was talking to women about it, I was like, when Sarah Schneer started, people didn't listen to her, you know? And that's kind of like what's going on. Even though it's a tiny little thing that we're starting an all-female ambulance service, but, you know, what?
Rots at her. The Belzer Hasidish boys threw rots at her. And this is the story. I've read it in a few different places. She said, from these rocks will I build my school. She's a tough lady.
And those rocks were Shalayim. What are they going to build? The ones that they're throwing now?
That spit at me, I will.
I suppose you read Yud Lamed Gordon's Kotei Shel Yud and put into classical Hebrew of the dismal state. of the dismal state of the Jewish woman in the Pale of Settlement. But even so, that was still written by a male author. My question is, at what point do we see that women possessed their own voice to express those very issues of inequality, suffrage, what have you, and their sexuality as something to talk about openly?
You know, a lot of the women just left intelligentsia just left the Jewish world. There were a few, Kava Shapira in the 1870s, Devorah Baron at the beginning of the 20th century. So, and then more and more, you know, and then, yeah.
Was it unique to the Yiddish language culture, or was it something that just a reflection of the times?
Some Hebrew. Kotzo Shel Yud was dedicated to Miriam Markel Moseson. I think I gotta stop talking, but it's thank you so much.
I'm gonna put this in the online. Observing the
Do you want people to reach you? Naomi@gtu.edu. Should I write it down?
Okay. Naomi@gtu.edu.
Didn't you give a talk?
No.
I was here last time and someone who looked like you gave a talk.
About what?
About literary theory.
Like a whole history of literary theory? That was, what's his name, I know who you're talking about. He used to work for the New York Sun.
Should I write my name?
Anyway, some Jewish group. What? That was like a year ago on 24th Street.
Yeah.